we're now trying to address, which is why Kitchen Table Woman of Color Press has come into being. We are women trying to create an institution that is committed to preserving and to spreading, to distributing and producing the words, the visions of women of color, of all women of color with a feminist vision of all sexualities, heritages, cultures, so that our artifacts will continue, that our artifacts will be there when we need them and when the women who follow us need them.
Well, that's also
all about the memory, the power of memory, and the necessity of memory, which can be kept alive by an oral tradition, but which in this kind of culture also needs to be kept alive by a written tradition. And then there's for me also the issue of, and I think for all of us, the issue of individual memory. Not just the memory of the group, the collective memory, whether of a specific people, whether of women, what have you, but the individual memories of all of us, which have to do with our past childhoods, where we are coming from, our perhaps confused and mingled in a society like this identities. I think very much of Wild Patience is a book, which is a book for memory, and that's the title of one of the poems. It's a book against amnesia. It's a book against all kinds of amnesia, social, historical, political, and personal. But one of the kinds of pain that I have had to I've had to go through, and I've had to find words for in this movement is the pain of rift, of rupture from women who with whom I shared a vision or believed I shared a vision, and I think that that's a kind of pain that many, many, many of us know for many, many different kinds of reasons or the many, many different kinds of issues that's often not spoken about, it's often not part of our analysis. We talk about fragmentation, we talk about the necessity to come together. But I think that behind that sense of necessity, that political necessity to heal fragmentation and come together, there has to be some kind of understanding that we, none of us arrived where we are, became who we are in some kind of twice-born way. We are not newborn, castless human beings, and that without acknowledging who we are and where we are coming from, rupture over and over again ensue, that we need to be very clear where we are coming from, and we need to understand where each other is coming from. And that is essentially the kind of memory I wanted to instill in this poem called For Memory. What I wanted to say to someone with whom communication is broken off, and as we often do, I try to say it in a poem, but I think that first and foremost I was saying it to and for myself. And certainly she is the person who I know will be using it. For memory, old words, trust, fidelity, nothing new yet to take their place. I rake leaves, clear the lawn, October grass painfully green beneath the gold. And in this silent labor, thoughts of you start up. I hear your voice, disloyalty, betrayal, stinging the wires. I stuff the old leaves into sacks, and still they fall, and still I see my work undone. one shivering, rain-swept afternoon, and the whole job to be done over. I can't know what you know unless you tell me. There are gashes in our understandings of this world. We came together in a common fury of direction, barely mentioning difference, what drew our finest hairs to fire, the deep, difficult troughs unvoiced. I fell through a basement rail the first day of school and cut my forehead open. Did I ever tell you? More than 40 years, and I still remember smelling my own blood like the smell of a new school book. And did you ever tell me how your mother called you in from play, and from whom to what? These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life we each and all bent out of orbit from, to which we must return simply to say, this is where I came from. This is what I knew. The past is not a husk, yet change goes on. Freedom, it isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine, remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds from all the lost collections. We're going to break now for about 10 minutes, at the end of which Betty Powell, the Asbury Foundation, will talk for a while. And then Audrey and I are going to sit and talk about very difficult, well, we're going to talk about work either in progress or work with which we've had a lot of trouble. And try to talk about why. Why is it so hard to write poetry?
Please take your seats. Thank you. Lot 67th and Park Corporation at 650 Park Avenue. Whoever dropped it was certainly needed in the car. All right, we'll have this at the desk outside when you realize it. All right, well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Betty Powell. I am a member of the board of directors of the Estrella Foundation, one of the organizations sponsoring this splendid event tonight. Other members of the board can be recognized by the red carnation we're wearing. Before we continue with the last half of our program, I would like to take a few minutes to tell you about the Estrella Foundation, what it is, and how we use the monies we receive from benefits like this one tonight. To the question, what is the Estrella Foundation? We are a multiracial, multi-ethnic social change organization that raises and distributes monies in support of women's projects. The foundation was founded in 1977, born of the vision of one woman in particular, Nancy Dean, and nine others who shared that vision. Why Women's Foundation? Estrella was formed, one, because women as a class are poor, economically, politically, and culturally disadvantaged, and have specific needs and talents which must be addressed. The Estrella Foundation was founded, secondly, because most existing foundations have virtually ignored projects which are directed principally to the concerns and talents of women. Funding is woefully inadequate, constituting a minuscule percentage of the total funding allocation of any corporate funding or private funding. Research has documented that women's projects receive less than 1/6 of 1% of the total dollar amount awarded by foundations. Research also gives us this outrageous statistic. Of 6 corporate foundations that derive their assets primarily from the sales of cosmetics to women, less than 5% of the annual $26 million or so granted go to women's programs. Added to that, five of these six corporate foundations granted less than 3% to women. I think we all know the other one cosmetic firm that gives some substantive amounts to women. Programs funded, and lastly, programs funded to serve both males and females often serve primarily males. Just one small example, statistics shows that the publicly funded alcoholism programs throughout the country tend to serve approximately 11% women clients. Okay. This is the unfortunate record of traditional corporate and private foundations. New liberal and alternative foundations have done better, but still do not begin to fill the gap that lies between women's funding and funding of others in the culture. In part, the smaller foundations cannot fund more because they are relatively small. Their funding, however, their funding priorities are not geared to women only. Estrella, then, is a vitally necessary foundation, along with the few other emerging women foundations around the country. Because it directs its funds to women of different races, classes, ethnic backgrounds, ages, and sexual orientations, in order to support their increased economic independence, personal and professional growth. Who receives specifically funding from the Estrella Foundation? Well, a broad range of projects designed by women and which have direct and personal relevance for the women they're designed for. We support the work of all women, but have an especial interest in the issues and projects of third world women, of older women, of lesbian women, female youth. These issues, or these particular areas of concern, by the way, are parallel with the issues and projects that meet with the greatest resistance in the funding world. Some of the projects that we have funded, I'd like to share just a few with you. In our first year, we were very excited to have among the projects we funded the Geneva Women's Resource Center. The Geneva Women's Resource Center is one which serves a mixed ethnic community of Hispanics, Blacks, and Whites in Geneva, New York. The grant is designed to develop bilingual audiovisual materials through a community project which involves all the women in the planning, directing, and acting of this film. The audiovisual materials will educate viewers on our society's promotion of violence against women and teach them how to recognize and deal with violence against themselves and other women. This particular project will have a double impact in that it will be shown to law enforcement agencies and medical personnel as well as to the community of upstate Geneva. WAND is a project that we've funded. WAND means Women Against Nuclear Development, and held a series of workshops in which they went around New England talking on the subject of women and nuclear development. WAND recognized that nuclear development is a clear example of a political decision from which women have been excluded, a decision which affects the lives of women and their potential offspring particularly. AIM to Incarcerated Mothers in Boston, Massachusetts, has received a grant from us. AIM is a unique program that gives community support and liaison service to mothers incarcerated at Framingham Prison in Framingham, Massachusetts. The grant will help support the salary of the liaison person who works to lessen the harmful effect of long separation on children and their mothers. AIM's purpose is to support mothers trying to maintain family relationships despite their incarceration. We funded, in our last cycle, Colectiva Lesbiana Latinoamericana in New York. The collective is designed to support the compiling and publishing of bilingual writings, poetry, prose, short stories, and an anthology to document Latina lesbian lives and history in the United States and Latin America. And the list goes on. We have funded film projects, theater ventures, prison newsletters, lesbian history archives, battered women's shelter. We will continue to fund, but we need your help. In the audience tonight, I see many friends of Estrella, some friends who were with us from the beginning and continue to hang in. I see many, many, many new faces at this event. We need the continued support of our old friends, and we need the support of our new friends. We have tonight at the tables in the lobby envelopes with pledge cards or donation cards in them. We are asking you to give whatever you can over and above what you paid for your ticket, from $1 to astronomical, you imagine it. If you have cash or your checkbook with you, dig into your hearts and your pockets and give us what you can. If you cannot do it tonight, please take an envelope. They are addressed to us, stamped. Take an envelope, and when you can, then dig into your heart and your pocket and support this work. Thank you very much.
I think we said that we thought in advance, we thought that this part of the program was going to be easier, but I'm finding it much harder. And I think that when we talk about the difficulty of what we're doing here, it's that we are trying through a different kind of format, I suppose you could say, to change some of the mental sets with which people come into a poetry reading or approach yeah. poems or approach poets, yeah. and which we feel is really important. I know that there are a lot of poets in this audience, some of them whose work has meant a great deal to me, and I believe to both of us,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of them whose work I don't know. I think what we're trying to do here, as Audrey said at the beginning, though, isn't just about poetry and poets. Rather, we are using that work, which is very crucial for us, to try to talk about processes of putting out the work, whatever the work is, whatever the work is that I, that you feel you have to do in the world, that you are called upon to do in the world, to move the world, to change the world.
Yet we recognize also that our lives are inseparable from our work, that our work and our lives are together, and that poetry, to the extent that it is part of our lives and part of our work, cannot be split. And that even what we've been doing here tonight, the kinds of examinations, the kind of nervousness, for instance, that each of us feels, has to do with the fact that there are no already set answers. There are no prescriptions. There are no already set rules that we can simply follow. And I think that it's good because both of us write and we stand at readings and we open the book and we read to a certain degree, even if it's a poem that was written an hour ago, it has already been written. And what we've been doing here is, in a sense, writing poetry as we speak.
Or trying, anyway, to reproduce what it was to be writing that poem. And we're going to do that even more in the next hour or so. I want, for myself, for my part in this, I have chosen to do something which is really very new for me and very hard for me, which is to talk about and read sections from a poem which is not just a poem in progress, but perhaps a poem that will never come into existence fully. Maybe I said to you, Audrey, and I think that it was a very valid perception. At one point this afternoon, I said, maybe what I'm doing is trying to put this poem in a place where I know it isn't the poem that I need to be writing. I need to go through this and do this with the poem that exists, with this piece of typescript, in order to write the poem that I really have to write around this part of my existence. If I ask myself what makes it so hard to write poetry, and I think it is very hard to write poetry, and I find it only gets harder. It doesn't really get easier.
That's
which
for
is
sure.
awful news, I know.
No, but it gets more rewarding, but it doesn't get easier.
But what I've been trying to break down for myself, what are some of the things that makes it so hard, and over again the word that comes up is fear. But it isn't just blanket abstract fear, it's fear of specific things. So what are they? And I know that one of the fears for me is the fear, because I know that poems do get out beyond us. You know, they're out there saying things that we're not ready to live our lives by. They also can be behind us, and that's very scary too. They can reflect to us parts of ourselves that we would like to think we had shed. But anyway, fear of saying things that reveal things about me that I am not ready to handle. And fear of my own defenses. The fear of getting... Well, first of all, I think the defense, by the time you're my age and have been writing as long as I've been writing, there are certain things you know how to do very well, and you can keep on doing them. And that can be... That can, on a certain kind of level, feel very satisfying, but that is not usually very productive for the kind of poetry that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that is hardest for me is knowing that I have those defenses, and I haven't really splendidly built up, and both in poetry and in my life. And the fear of getting taken over by an old voice that I don't want anymore, but that is going to try to speak through me. And I was saying to you today that it's sort of like the invasion of the body snatchers, and I think poetry is a place where you can see the invasion of the body snatchers. Amazingly, all kinds of body snatchers. We are always reading poetry that is inhabited by other people's voices. And by our own voices, which are not really our own voices anymore.
Or an older voice, an older self.
And then there is something that I call the poetry voice, which is, you know, that voice, you know. I think that the poetry voice for me is a white male voice. I suspect it strongly is. I mean, I don't think it's the poetry voice, but it's something with capital letters that we've been taught to listen for. So I'm often held back, blocked by the fear that once I start writing, one of these voices is going to take over, and I'm not going to be able to do it. You know, I'm not going to be able to get at the stuff that I need to get at. I'm not going to be able to go back to that place where the unanswered questions are and let them be unanswered if they have to be. And I think in this connection of another thing that Jan Clausen talked about in that essay, which was the seeming need of feminist poetry for a sort of upending, mm-hmm. For an ending which promises us that all will be well in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a fear of wanting that so much, too. And I think ultimately there's a fear of writing something that will make me feel absolutely alone, absolutely isolated, absolutely without comradeship, either because it has revealed me as someone who does not even deserve to have comrades, or simply because it reveals me as, or because it reveals me to myself as in some place of ultimate isolation. And I find that very terrifying. I think that particular fear has been very prevalent in my efforts to write this poem, some pieces of which I'm going to read. I think that the question of voice in this poem is also very problematical for me. And I think that there's another element, which I will talk about later, which has made this poem problematic for me. The title I've given it is Sources, and it was written in several days at the end of the summer after several months of silence. I mean, not total writing silence, but silence, poetry silence. And at the end of the summer of a very difficult year, a year of a lot of elements in my life converging that I knew I needed to bring together but didn't have any graph or plan, a map of how. At the very beginning of this year, I had gone down to Florida to do a workshop with a group of Southern lesbians, and a poetry workshop, and it was a very intense period at which I learned a great deal. One of the things that was important about it for me was that my own background is Southern, that both my parents, all of my grandparents, and so on and so forth, all the way back, were Southerners, and that meeting with these Southern women was something that I knew was going to be tremendously important to me, but I didn't know exactly how or why. A great deal of the time with them, I felt like an outsider, although many things that I was hearing, many things in their poetry, many things in their talk, were so familiar to me as to touch off profound levels of feeling. And there was that. And then there was, at the beginning of the summer, a workshop that Ellie Balkin and Gloria Greenfield did at NORSA for Jewish women on anti-Semitism and racism, which was for me, in a different and more perhaps condensed way, a very powerful experience. And it was the first time that I had gone into any feminist group identifying as a Jewish woman. And one of the things that happened there for me was a recognition that I was not as alone as I had thought I was in feeling tremendous confusion about my Jewishness, tremendous confusion about my relationship to anti-Semitism, tremendous confusion about the connections between anti-Semitism and racism. And that workshop catalyzed for me a great deal of thinking, a great deal of sort of unorganized, uncalculated, undefined kinds of feeling about being a Jewish woman who, in an old poem years back, had described myself as follows: split at the root, neither Gentile nor Jew, Yankee nor Southern, I'm a good reader of histories. And what I was trying to say there was that my father was a Jew, my mother was not, and I didn't know what to do with that. I was raised as a Christian. But all of this being part of the struggle against amnesia, the struggle to reclaim memory, the struggle to reclaim strands of the past which had been denied me, in part in the effort to make me into that achieving young, white, middle-class, American, Christian woman that I was supposed to be, without a Southern accent, preferably. A feeling of really needing to peel myself out from the wallpaper of my life. I mean, it was sort of the reverse of Charlotte Perkins Gilman's story, in a way. And I think that this poem bears the marks of a lot of struggle with all of that. As I look at it now, it seems to me to speak most eloquently of the need to go back to poetry to explore this material which was so painful and so unanswerable, unanalyzable, so undealable with in any of the rational ways that it might have felt better to deal with it, to go back to poetry and try to start from there. And I guess that is, you know, what we've been talking about all along. If you're a poet, that's what you do ultimately, is to go back to poetry for that. Then the result may not be the poem that you wanted to write. And this is still obviously not that poem. Part of what I was trying to work with in the poem was the enormous identification I have had with the New England landscape, particularly the landscape of a specific part of Vermont, and the fact that no Southern landscape has ever meant so much to me. And then I have to ask myself why, and what did that journey north, both psychically and geographically, stand for? How did it stand for, in part, the shedding of an identity in order to become part of something which appeared cleaner, more moral, more righteous, more liberal than my Southern antecedents. Anyway, I'm just going to read some sections of this poem, and I'm going to comment on them because I think that I think if someone handed me this poem and said, you know, if I were not so myself so involved with it, if it were not my poem, if I had not written these words, but someone had given this to me, I suppose my response would have been, you're trying to do about 12 things at once here, and they really are connected, but you haven't found the connections yet, or something like that.